Hi folks. Apologies for skipping a week with the podcast. It was Christmas week and I took a break off from podcasting for a while. But now we're back, and this week we're going to step back a few decades before the Troubles, to the early 1900s, to talk about a man by the name of Edward Carson. The year is 1914, and there are 1 million Unionists in the north of Ireland who are concerned about the growing threat of Irish independence. They want to resist it at all costs, believing that Irish independence will mean that they will soon become ruled by the Catholic Church in the Vatican and that their religion will be less valued. Edward Carson was the man who would lead the Unionist resistance and facilitate the birth of the Loyalist paramilitary, but instead of targeting the Irish nationalists, he would have his sights firmly set on the British government. This is the story of Edward Carson, who some call the father of Unionism in Northern Ireland, and how he brought about the birth of the Loyalist paramilitary. This is the Troubles podcast, a podcast about the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a bloody conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. Edward Carson was born in Harcourt Street in 1854, to the wealthy architect Edward Henry Carson. His mother, Isabella, belonged to a wealthy landed family from Galway. The Carson family were originally Scottish, with Edward's grandfather moving over to Dublin from Dumfries in 1815. Edward was Anglo-Irish, which is a common term from the time, meaning people of English descent born or residing in Ireland. The Anglo-Irish people in Ireland were often significantly wealthier than their Irish counterparts. Edward had three brothers, and they were brought up in a fairly strict household, with his father, Edward Sr., deciding that Edward Jr. was to become a lawyer. Edward Jr. showed little aptitude in school. He spent many of his early days quite sickly. He hated playing sports and would feign all sorts of illnesses so as to avoid having to take part in physical activity in school. Carson sat the entrance exam for the prestigious Trinity College at the age of 17. He sat the exam at the same time as Dubliner Oscar Wilde. Wilde had won a scholarship, while Carson only just about passed the exam. Though the two were never friends, they were part of the same society, the Historical Society, which was a society centred around debating, something which would play a large part in Carson's life. Carson and Wilde's paths would cross again a few years later over in England, but we'll get to that later. In the Historical Society, Carson would spend a lot of time debating issues of the day, such as if hanging was ethical and whether it was a good idea to create a Catholic university, as Trinity College was very much a Protestant university. Carson graduated from Trinity and was called to the Irish Bar, beginning his legal apprenticeship in Dublin, taking on a number of cases. He even defended his father in one case. In 1879, Carson met and fell in love with Annette Kirwan. She was from a poor family, and Carson's father disliked her and refused to attend their wedding. The two settled in Dublin, where Carson continued to find work, and began raising his young family. Some of his early work included defending Irish tenants who took cases against their landlords, but as his career progressed, he would eventually end up on the other side, taking part in cases against those which he had earlier defended, after the introduction of the Crimes Act. By 1886, Carson had three children and lived in a house overlooking Stephen's Green in the centre of Dublin city. He had developed a reputation as a brilliant barrister and orator, and was one of the most prominent barristers in Ireland at the time. At the age of 35, he was brought to England, where he was first a lawyer for the English courts before being appointed the title of Solicitor General for Ireland, which meant that he advised the Crown on all matters relating to Ireland. One of his most notable cases was against Irish poet and playwright Oscar Wilde. Wilde had been engaged in a romantic relationship with Lord Alfred Douglas. Homosexuality at the time was illegal, and Douglas's father, John, wanted Wilde to stop seeing his son. John left a calling card at a club which read, quote, "For Oscar Wilde, posing sodomite." He was essentially publicly calling Wilde gay. As a result of this, and against the wishes of his friends, Wilde initiated legal proceedings against Douglas's father for libel, in order to clear his name. By this stage, Wilde was earning money from his profession, and the public knowledge that he was gay could have been very damaging to his reputation, and would likely result in a prison sentence. John Douglas was arrested for criminal libel, but could avoid charges if he could prove that his accusation that Wilde was gay was indeed true. Douglas then hired Edward Carson to mount his defence. Carson was part of a team that included private detectives who delved deep into the life of Oscar Wilde, interviewing many male prostitutes that Wilde had been friendly with. The trial became a media sensation, and in court, Carson squared off against the eloquent Wilde. Wilde was charming in the courts, drawing great laughs from the crowd, but Carson had an abundance of proof and also managed to question Wilde into a corner on many occasions. At one point, Carson asked Wilde if he had ever kissed one particular servant boy, to which Wilde responded, quote, "Oh dear no, he was a particularly plain boy, unfortunately ugly. I pitied him for it." Carson continued to press him, asking him if the only reason he didn't kiss him was because he was ugly. Wilde became flustered, saying, quote, "You sting me and insult me and try to unnerve me. And at times one says things flippantly when one ought to speak more seriously." Wilde's friends encouraged him to flee the country, but he refused. There was also a significant amount of witness testimony against him, in the form of male prostitutes, and as a result, Wilde dropped his case against Douglas, but was ordered to pay his legal fees. This left him penniless, and he was then subsequently charged with sodomy and gross indecency. Wilde was found guilty of these charges and sentenced to 2 years hard labour. He never recovered from his time in prison and died 3 years after getting out. I've read conflicting sources regarding Carson and Wilde's relationship. One source said that Carson took no pleasure in the case that would eventually ruin Wilde, and that he secretly intervened in an attempt to stop the subsequent court case against Wilde. Another source said that Carson resented how Wilde betrayed his own social class by consorting with rent boys and prostitutes. Though the court case was devastating for Wilde, it was a massive boost to Carson's career, and the trial has gone on to become one of the most famous trials in British history. Between this and some other larger cases, Carson had soon become one of the most prominent politicians in the United Kingdom. By now he was earning around £20,000 a year, which was a massive amount of money back then. He moved his wife and family over to London, but his wife soon grew depressed in London and became addicted to gambling and horse racing, something which she hid from Carson. Her health soon began to fail and she died in 1913. Carson remarried in 1914 to Ruby Frewen, who was only 29 while Carson was 60. It turns out that he had actually met Ruby while in an unhappy marriage and the two had been having an affair. Here's old footage of Ruby talking about when she first met Carson.
I used to stay a great deal with the Hall Walkers, and the funny thing was I was never introduced to him. I came back from playing golf one day and he was talking with Lord Goschen and Sir Edward Lascelles, and I went back and I said to Mrs. Hall Walker, "Do you think I've seen Sir Edward Carson?" "Yes," she said, "then you've met the rudest man in England."
Of course, you'd heard of him by that time.
Yes, I'd heard of him by that time.
At that time, he must have been about 60 and you around 30. What was it about this man twice your age that attracted you to him?
Well, I really don't know, but immediately I was. And then the next day, I went down to the golf links. It was a very hot day, and I sat in a chair to read a book. And suddenly I heard a chair being pulled over the gravel, and he sat down beside me.
And that was that?
And began to talk to me, and that was that.
That's the basics when it comes to Carson's personal life, but now let's roll it back and just talk about his relationship to Ireland. He loved Ireland and considered himself a liberal unionist. His aims were simple: to protect the British Empire and maintain the union between Ireland and the United Kingdom. But when it came to maintaining this union, Carson would have his work cut out for him. In the late 1800s, Ireland was still a part of the United Kingdom and was governed from Westminster in England. The country had been occupied by the British since the 1100s, and there was a growing number of people who wanted to be free from British rule. As well as that, Ireland had just come out of a devastating famine, which left a distinct anti-British sentiment around the country, as many felt that the British government did little to prevent the millions of people who starved to death. Charles Stewart Parnell was another Anglo-Irishman born around the same time as Carson, and it was Parnell who was at the forefront of what became known as the Home Rule movement. Home Rule was the start of an Irish push for independence from the United Kingdom, In its most basic form, Home Rule was self-governance for Ireland within the United Kingdom. Ireland would have their own parliament, but would still swear allegiance to the British Crown. Some Irish nationalists believed that Home Rule was a stepping stone to complete Irish independence from the UK, whereas other nationalists were completely against it and wanted total Irish independence. There was also many Anglo-Irish and Unionists who lived in Ireland and wanted it to remain a part of the UK. By this time, there was a lot of Unionists in Northern Ireland, significantly more than anywhere else in the country. This was as a result of the very successful Ulster plantation back in the 1600s. Most of the people who settled there were of Scottish origin and had been thriving for the years since. These Ulster Scots, as they were known, vehemently wanted to remain a part of the UK and resist the perceived ever-growing threat of Irish independence. So Home Rule was a concept that they would not accept. Just for context, there was about 1 million Unionists in Northern Ireland, when compared with about 3 million Irish nationalists in the rest of the country. Meanwhile, at the British Parliament in Westminster, the new Liberal government under Prime Minister Asquith had gained power with a majority of just 2 seats. This meant that the Irish Party and other Irish nationalists who were in Parliament would go on to hold the balance of power in Westminster. And Asquith would need them on his side if he wanted to get anything done. They wanted Home Rule in Ireland, so Asquith complied and supported their demand. What Asquith didn't realise was the level of Unionist opposition that would occur in Northern Ireland. So why did they oppose Home Rule so much? Unionists feared that if Nationalists got into power and Ireland became self-governed, then they, the Protestant Unionists, would be ruled by an overwhelmingly Catholic state. There was a slogan going around at the time saying, "Home Rule is Rome Rule," meaning that Ireland would be ruled by the Vatican City if they secured Home Rule. Some could argue that this did indeed come true, as the Catholic Church was eventually enshrined in the Irish Constitution in 1937. As well as that, Belfast in the early 1900s was one of the premier industrial cities in the world, and Unionists were worried that Home Rule would affect this status. In February of 1912, Asquith's cabinet colleague, Winston Churchill, travelled over to Northern Ireland to present the case for Home Rule to the politicians there, and he was met with fierce resistance. Things were so tense that the British Army had to deploy 5 battalions to guarantee Churchill's safety when he attended a rally in the city. He even had to slip out of the city quietly for fear of violence against him. In response to the threat of Home Rule, the Unionist MPs in Northern Ireland went on to form the Ulster Unionist Council, which was a group dedicated to resisting Home Rule at all costs. Ulster stood alone in its opposition, feeling like it had been betrayed by perceived sneaky tactics between Asquith and the Irish Nationalists. MP for East Down, James Craig, would have been considered the architect for the Unionist opposition. He realised that in order to successfully argue the case against Home Rule, that they would need a person who possessed the stamina, skills, experience and charisma to do so. And this is where Edward Carson comes back in. Is something preventing you from reaching your goals or interfering with your happiness? If so, check out this episode's sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp can assess your needs and match you with a licensed therapist. It isn't a crisis line or a self-help line. With BetterHelp, you can connect with licensed counselors who specialize in a range of issues, including depression, stress, and anxiety. You can send a message to your counselor anytime and schedule weekly phone and video sessions, all from the comfort of your own home. It's also more affordable than traditional offline counseling and offers much more options. Start living a happier life today. As a Troubles podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/troubles. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/troubles. By this stage, Carson was very well known and established as an exceptionally skilled speaker, who was well liked and respected by many. In 1910, Carson was elected the leader of the Irish Unionist Parliamentary Party, which was full of Ulster Unionists. Initially, they were unsure of Carson at first. He had a Dublin accent and had been working over in London, so they were unsure if he had their best values at heart. But Carson was strongly opposed to Irish independence and dead set against the idea of home rule, believing that the Irish nationalists were being disloyal to the Union. In September 1911, James Craig mobilised 50,000 Unionists to greet Carson and welcome him as their new leader. Carson addressed the crowd, saying, quote, "I know the responsibility you are putting on me today. In your presence, I cheerfully accept it, grave as it is. And I now enter into a compact with you and every one of you, and with the help of God, you and I together will yet defeat the most nefarious conspiracy that has ever been hatched against a free people." These words were widely reported in Ireland and the UK, to which Churchill dismissed them, calling them the, quote, "trivial frothings of a Unionist politician." On April 12, 1912, the Home Rule Bill was passed in the British Parliament. Then, 3 days later, the Titanic sank. The Titanic was built in Belfast and represented the pride of industrial Belfast. After this, the sense of dread and foreboding amongst Unionists in Northern Ireland was palpable. Something drastic had to be done, and this would take the form of the Ulster Solemn League and Covenant. This was a commitment which would be signed by anyone opposed to the Home Rule Bill. It was essentially a manifesto setting out the case against Home Rule, but also promising to move Unionists into violent action if necessary. Signing this covenant would bind the signatory to a defiant defence of Ulster. Here's the full transcript of the covenant. "Being convinced in our consciousness that Home Rule would be disastrous to the material well-being of Ulster, as well as the whole of Ireland, subversive of our civil and religious freedom, destructive of our citizenship, and perilous to the unity of the Empire, we, whose names are underwritten, Men of Ulster, loyal subjects of His Gracious Majesty King George V, humbly relying on the God whom our fathers in days of stress and trial confidently trusted, do hereby pledge ourselves in solemn covenant, throughout this, our time of threatened calamity, to stand by one another in defending, for ourselves and our children, our cherished position of equal citizenship in the United Kingdom, and in using all means which may be found necessary to defeat the present conspiracy to set up a Home Rule Parliament in Ireland. And in the event of such a Parliament being forced upon us, we further solemnly and mutually pledge ourselves to refuse to recognise its authority. In sure confidence that God will defend the right, we hereto subscribe our names. And further, we individually declare that we have not already signed this covenant." This was the covenant for men. There was a separate declaration which was similar and was signed by women. On the day the covenant was first signed, Carson and Unionists all over Ulster went to church service where they heard sermons which drew parallels between what they were about to sign and the Old Testament covenants between God and the Israelites. The covenant was signed throughout September 1912. The first signatory was Carson, and then over the next few days, 237,368 men signed the covenant, and 234,046 women signed the declaration. Most of the signatories were Ulster Unionists, but there were just under 1,000 Southern Unionists who travelled to Ulster to sign it. There was also around 2,000 people in Dublin who signed it. Carson paid tribute to them in a speech, saying, quote, "My own fellow citizens from Dublin, from Wicklow, from Clare, and yes, from Cork, rebel Cork, who are now holding the hand of Ulster." Author of The Jungle Book, Rudyard Kipling, was friends with Carson, and also dead set against Irish nationalism. He believed that before the English arrived in Ireland, quote, "the Irish were a gang of cattle thieves living in savagery and killing each other, while writing dreary poems about it all." Kipling wrote a poem to immortalise the signing of the covenant, called Ulster 1912. Here's an excerpt from the poem. "We know the war prepared on every peaceful home. We know the hell's prepared for such as serve not Rome. The terror threats and bred in market, hearth and field. We know when all is said, we perish if we yield." There was also a rumour that staunch loyalist Frederick Hugh Crawford signed the covenant in his own blood. But an analysis of the signature has taken place in recent years, ruling that there is a 90% chance that it's not signed in his blood, but rather just red ink. With the signing of the Covenant completed on the 28th of September, that date became known as Ulster Day. The Covenant was worded specifically to say that violence was an option if the Crown continued to push Home Rule through Parliament. And in the months before the signing, there were the first whispers of the setting up of a loyalist paramilitary group. But funnily enough, not to fight against the Irish nationalists, but in fact to fight against the British Crown. At the beginning of the year, the fraternal group, the Orange Order, began organising small militias and drilling. And then on April 9th, 100,000 men marched in columns. Then, in January 1913, the Ulster Volunteer Force was officially established. So now we have Carson leading the political resistance against Home Rule. We have hundreds of thousands of people signing a covenant to oppose it, and now we have a paramilitary group dedicated to violently opposing it. They just needed one thing: guns. According to some sources, Carson seemed initially reluctant to support a plan to import arms into the country from Germany, but he soon came around to the idea and gave it his blessing. So on April 24th, 1914, a large shipment of arms composed of about 25,000 rifles and 3 million rounds of ammunition arrived in the port of Larne in Northern Ireland, destined for the UVF. They arrived on a Norwegian cargo vessel, which was named the SS Fanny. And the guns had been ordered by the alleged Blood signatory, Frederick Hugh Crawford. It should be noted that Germany also sent a shipment of around 1,000 arms to the pro-Home Rule Irish nationalists later that year, so they weren't exactly loyal to either side. The British government was not happy to hear about this shipment, but did little to prevent it. Soon to be Prime Minister of the UK, Lloyd George, said that Carson lived by the law and now flouted it. Here's where it gets a bit complicated. Many of the pro-Home Rule Irish nationalists weren't happy that Carson had welcomed the threat of violence and believed that he was breaking the rules. But then there were other Irish nationalists who had different opinions, and were delighted that Carson was squaring off against the British government. In response to the foundation of the Ulster Volunteers, an Irish nationalist force was founded, who became known as the Irish Volunteers. With Northern Ireland on the brink of civil war, world events would put everything on hold. The Great War, aka World War I, kicked off in 1914, and with that, Carson offered the services of the Ulster Volunteers to aid the British Army. The men of the 36th Ulster Division went off to fight. Carson could have used this time to launch an attack against the Crown while they were distracted by events in Germany, but he chose not to, saying, quote, "England's difficulty is not Ulster's opportunity. However we are treated, we do not seek to purchase terms by selling our patriotism." Despite his perceived honour, it was during World War I that Home Rule was finally passed in Westminster, but the implementation was suspended until after the war. As the war raged on, Asquith's Liberal government was forced to enter into the UK's first ever coalition government, and Carson was appointed to serve as Attorney General, which was the principal legal advisor to the government. This came as a surprise to many, since Carson supported buying arms to forcefully resist the government just a few years ago. Lloyd George then replaced Asquith as Prime Minister, after Asquith was accused of mishandling the war effort. Carson was then given a new title, the First Lord of the Admiralty. This was at a time when German U-boats were wreaking havoc in the seas. Carson didn't deal with this problem very effectively, and was subsequently replaced. When the war ended, Carson was tired of his time spent in government, and he retired from the public eye. But during these final few years of the war, Ireland had continued to agitate for independence from the UK, and the final Home Rule Bill was then introduced in 1920. The Ulster Unionists, having just fought in World War I, had no desire to return home from war only to jump into another civil war. So the only real solution was partition. The Government of Ireland Act of 1920, which was also known as the fourth and final Home Rule Bill, saw six counties of Ireland partitioned and remain a part of the UK. The south of Ireland would still remain a part of the UK, but be self-governed. By this stage, it had taken 8 years to get the bill across the line, and the terms were a bit outdated. and the Irish nationalists declared the south of Ireland its own republic, with the idea of a union between Ireland and the UK shattered. Carson's influence over unionism waned, and he realised that he was fighting a losing battle, and resigned from his post as leader of the Ulster Unionist Party. Carson never wanted Ireland to split, or be partitioned, so this new executive in Northern Ireland really didn't fit into his vision for his beloved Ireland. He was invited to become the first Prime Minister of Northern Ireland in 1921, but declined, and James Craig took up the post instead. Carson moved to Kent in England to live out his final few years, which were marred with depression and illness. In 1933, he travelled to the Northern Irish Parliament, Stormont, to see the unveiling of a statue in his honour, which still stands there today. Carson died on October 22, 1935, and was given a full state funeral in Belfast. After his death, there was a concerted effort to portray him as the heroic embodiment of the militant unionist spirit. But it is more complicated. He never really wanted to take up arms against the Crown, but he did believe that he was betrayed by the MPs in the British government, who he believed pushed Home Rule across the line for their own selfish political gain. When handing over leadership of the Ulster Unionist Council, Carson gave them some final advice. And that's where we'll finish this episode. Quote, "From the outset, let us see that the Catholic minority have nothing to fear from the Protestant majority. Let us take care to win all that is best amongst those who have been opposed to us in the past, while maintaining intact our own religion. Let us give the same rights to the religion of our neighbours." It's up to you to decide whether Carson's advice was heeded or not. That's it for me. Thanks, and see you next time. The Patreon is a great way to show your support. I release the episodes there early, and I also put out a companion video with each episode. On Patreon, the episodes are also completely ad-free, and you can listen on your own personal RSS feed on your podcast player. I'll also be posting there the full show notes for every episode. You can support the podcast over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. Alternatively, if you'd like to support the podcast in a once-off fashion, you can do that over at buymeacoffee.com/thetroublespodcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving reviews or simply telling your friends. It all helps.